But now at 9:30, it's time for this week's Sunday feature, The Pleasure Telephone. As part of the BBC's A Passion for Opera season, Edward Seckerson tells the remarkable story of how the early telephone was used to create radio before radio, with live opera very much to the fore.
Hello? Yeah, Edward speaking. Oh, hi. Look, I can't talk just now because I'm just off to Paris. I'm investigating how they could listen to live opera on the telephone back in 1881. Yeah. No, I haven't been in the Burgundy. Look, I better run. They're calling the train. I'll give you a call when I get back, OK? Cheers. Have I been at the Burgundy?
The telephone needed ways of showing how it worked. Music was a very good way.
The idea that you could actually send not just a signal, but an experience to somebody else. It must have been the wonder of the age.
You could settle down with headphones over your head and hear in real time what was actually coming through live from the stage for as long as you wished.
Well, here I am in Paris at a spot between the River Seine and the Champs-Élysées. And this is where the Palais d'Industrie, the Palace of Industry, once stood. It was an exhibition centre intended to rival the Crystal Palace in London. So imagine we're back in 1881. Electricity is the wonder of the age, and a mammoth electrical exhibition is on here at the Palais. The entrepreneur Clément Ader is creating a sensation with a demonstration of his telephone. This is just 5 years after Alexander Graham Bell had shown that sound could travel down wires. And what sound does Ader use to demonstrate the telephone for visitors to the exhibition? Live performances from the Grand Opera in Paris. Telephone historian Neil Johansson owns a British newspaper of the day which featured this great miracle.
What we have here is the front cover of an illustrated newspaper called The Graphic from September the 24th, 1881. And it has actually five pictures on it. Across the top of it, the telephonic opera room. And you've got the best part of 20 people, all holding earpieces against their heads, and they're listening to the opera. They're all appreciating and enjoying the music.
Well, I'm now looking back at the 1881 exhibition site from the Place de la Concorde. And I've got with me a report in the Scientific American from someone who was at the electrical exhibition. He'd noticed an extraordinary effect when listening to this opera relay. The singers placed themselves in the mind of the listener, some to the right and others to the left. It's easy to follow their movements and to indicate exactly each time that they change their position, the imaginary distance at which they appear to be. Well, it's explained that each listener is in fact hearing the opera on two separate telephone receivers, one for each ear, linked to separate transmitters on the stage, suggesting something not a million miles from what we now know as stereo. Relaying live music and entertainment became one key selling point for the early telephone on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm now at Covent Garden with Francesca Franchi of the Royal Opera House Archive. Francesca, in what way was the Royal Opera House involved?
Well, we know that in 1899, performances were relayed by the Electrophone Company down telephone lines so that people could hear performances live from the Royal Opera House. What we've got in the archives is a programme for the performances that were relayed that season, and it shows six performances relayed in June and July of 1899.
Mm. Some pretty heavyweight stuff, including three Wagner operas, Tristan and Isolde, Tannhäuser and Lohengrin.
And we've got a photograph showing people in the act of listening to a performance being relayed from Covent Garden. Ladies and gentlemen in full evening dress, sitting in what looks like either a theatre lobby or a hotel lobby. and all listening very intently with their earphones on.
It's astounding to think that, you know, a house of this eminence, that people could listen in this way. And in fact, on the programme here, it says theatres, music halls, concert halls, places of worship, etc., switched on at home and heard to perfection. And perhaps we can imagine the likes of Dame Nellie Melba filling the hall here and making an impact down the telephone wires as well. As I'll be explaining, the newfangled telephone was used to offer subscribers everything from news and children's story times to acts of worship and even adverts, never mind the enduring popularity of music. As a journalist involved in plenty of 21st century internet projects, I'm amazed at how modern this late 19th century enterprise seems. Back to the beginning then.
Yeah, in front of us is a cabinet which contains some of the earliest transmitters and receivers used for both the telephone experiments and early telephones.
At the Connected Earth Telecommunications Museum down in Sussex, part of the Amberley Working Museum, volunteer curator Fred Stanford points out replicas of two of Alexander Graham Bell's famous telephones of the 1870s.
The first is the gallows, which he experimented with first. Then we have the liquid transmitter, which looks like a beaker on a stand. The container below held a liquid that conducted electricity. It was this transmitter that Bell was using when he made the first call.
Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you. That alleged first phone transmission to Bell's assistant may have been in the form of speech, but the telephone wasn't automatically seen as a medium for two-way conversation. And as Neil Johansson explains, potential consumers had no preconception of what a phone was for.
People at those times couldn't see why it was useful, couldn't see what it could do, couldn't, in some cases, believe it would work. Think in terms of the early internet. When there's very few things on the web, why bother having it? Once you get a lot of things on the internet, you start to think, oh, I could use that. I can see what that would mean to me. So there was a lot of people who were pushing the idea of the telephone and what it could do and thinking of all sorts of ways of demonstrating it. If you can hear good music, you can hear singing, you can hear opera, then you have a way of really appreciating how it worked.
And opera provided the ideal type of sound to surmount the shortcomings of early telephones. Tim Crook, head of radio at Goldsmiths College in London.
You had an inferior technology, very poor quality indeed, graphite microphones that could pick up the powerful projection of operatic singing. So musical theatre, opera, was the ideal medium.
The earliest reference we found to the use of the telephone to transmit live music comes from June 1878, really just months after Bell's invention. And this wasn't in the USA, but in Switzerland, a production of Don Pasquale in Bellinzona. What we're talking about here seems to be the ad hoc use of the telephone for such purposes, not yet the commercial development of a range of over-the-phone products. There are wonderful accounts of early local initiatives, in the United States, for example.
Electrical Review, September 6, 1884. The Dallas Telephone Exchange gave the surrounding exchanges a complimentary concert recently. The soul-stirring strains fell upon hundreds of appreciative ears. The orchestra was seated in a large room in the exchange, in which were transmitters. Waxahachie, Lancaster, Tyrrell, McKinney, Fort Worth, Cleburne, Waco, and Dallas subscribers were treated to a musical feast.
And local exchanges soon worked out how they could use the phone to shrink the vast agricultural spaces of America. Tim Crook.
The telephone offered a chance for the end of isolation. You needed to know about farm prices. You needed to know about weather. You needed to know about diseases, general news. And also, you wanted to be entertained. So imagine these rural homesteads playing music to each other, shared on the telephone line, and there being immediate feedback, clapping, you know, across hundreds of miles.
What some feared, though, was that any old music would find its way down telephone wires.
Fancy the horrors of having one's disposition wrecked by a popular program. And what new terrors would be added to the boarding house when Sweet Violets and other appetite-destroying tunes would be turned loose at feeding time.
Back here to Paris. The early telephone was certainly being used extensively to relay entertainment in the land of its birth, the USA. But the famous company names in the early commercial exploitation of the technology that have come down to us are European, starting with the Théatrophone, or Theatrophone, company here in Paris. The entrepreneur involved was Clément Ader, the guy who demonstrated his telephones at that 1881 electrical exhibition. He piggybacked the developing telephone network to deliver live entertainment not just to people's homes, but to hotels and restaurants. Sean Street of the Bournemouth Media School.
Clément Ader creates the Théatrophone in around about 1890, and the clue's in the title, isn't it? Because it's live theatre, in many cases live opera, coming into your homes via the telephone. And you could subscribe to that. And that really did catch the imagination. One writer of the time said it was a perfect device to capture the ears and the centimes of the subscribers.
The Théâtre Français, the Opéra Comique, the Bouffe, the Nouveauté have already consented to admit the Théâtrophone. And before long, almost all the theatres will form part of the Théâtrophonic network. The delight to be got out of such an instrument during a long winter evening of snow or rain is obvious.
OK, off the metro, and there's the sign for the Opéra Comique. Well, here I am actually on stage at Paris's Opéra Comique, which was once mic'd up for Théâtrophone. What a sight it is, too. It's a gorgeously ornate auditorium, but with an intimacy about it. I'm hearing strains of Bizet's Carmen, which was premiered here, and also probably the howls of derision that greeted it. There would have been a Théâtrophone attendant here in the house during performances, making sure all was well. A bit like a radio producer, I suppose. So how did the system work? Well, if you were a domestic telephone customer and also had a Théâtrophone subscription, you picked up your phone and asked to be put through to the Théâtrophone office. From there, you were connected to your choice of venue. Opéra Comique, s'il vous plaît. It was as easy as that, really. There was no more enthusiastic Théâtrophone user than the novelist Marcel Proust. In failing health, he beavered away at the massive remembrance of things past in his cork-lined room above me here at 102 Boulevard Haussmann. A bank owns the building now, and they've said we can't go up to Proust's room for security reasons, but we can imagine him up there above the noise of the streets, seeking escape in Wagner and Debussy over his phone line. Music writer Patrick O'Connor.
He wrote to Rinaldo Hahn in 1910, and in the letter he says, yesterday I heard the whole of the third act of Meistersinger, Maître Chanteur, as he says, and today all of Pelléas. And so he heard Pelléas and Mélisande from the Opéra Comique all the way through. Proust, of course, was very enthusiastic about that opera. He'd been to one of the rehearsals of it in 1902. So it's rather nice to think of him lying in that cork-lined room.
Dépêche-toi, demande à Pelléas d'y aller avec moi.
Pelléas, avec Pelléas.
diaspora tout ce que tu lui demandes. Je connais Péléas mieux que toi. Vas-y, hâte-toi.
If you wanted to access the Theatrophone service in a restaurant, you'd probably find yourself using a coin in the slot machine, the forerunner of the kit in this gleaming Parisian phone booth, although you'd need a credit card to work this one. There was talk of Clément Ader extending the scope of the Theatrophone beyond music and theatre, with plans to mic up the French Parliament, the Assemblée Nationale here by the Seine, and to transmit news. A spoken daily paper which will carry all the latest news at home and abroad, as one journalist reported.
Well, did those rumours influence the man who was perhaps the editorial genius of this new technology, the Hungarian entrepreneur Theodor Puskás? After working for the Paris Telephone Company, he went back to Budapest and founded Telefon Hirmondo, Telephone Herald, in 1893. Yes, this offered subscribers children's concerts, folk music, and regular dollops of opera, including surely Hungarian opera. But the central thread from early morning to late night was news.
10 to 10.30, local stock exchange quotations. 10.30 to 11, chief contents of local daily press. 11 to 11.15, general news and finance. 11.15 to 11.30, local theatrical and sporting news.
Because Telefon Hirmondo laid its own telephone lines, it had more editorial independence. Tim Crook sees the company as a radio station in all but name.
You had an editorial person in charge. You had a director, a program controller. You had stentors, people who were sent out to collect the news and present it. And they had to have bright, articulate, powerful voices. In other words, they were thinking about the communication of information through the voice. You had a part of the business that was responsible for specialising in certain areas, finance, business, the courts, politics, even children's entertainment, in storytelling and so on.
And how futuristic was this? Telefon Hirmondo's budget included income from broadcasting adverts. These were carefully scheduled. For instance, as one report observed, between two particularly interesting items of news. The large staff of around 150 allowed Telefon Hirmondo to mount special event programming. In 1896, the company added a special dimension to Hungary's millennium celebrations. Telecommunications historian Peter Young.
The nation looked back to the Magyar settlement of 896, and the hero of the time was the first crown king of Hungary, St. Stephen. And there were all sorts of programmes about all the events being staged. So it really did come into its own as an element in Hungarian nationalism.
In its heyday, Telefon Hirmondo had over 6,000 subscribers. Not a vast number, but certainly indicating the service was more than a toy for the idle rich. And it certainly reached various levels of society. Here's the writer Arthur Mee in 1898, dubbing Telefon Hirmondo the pleasure telephone.
The most wonderful feature of the pleasure telephone is its cheapness. The charge to subscribers is only a penny a day, or 30 shillings a year. No hotel in Budapest can afford to be without the instrument, which has become practically indispensable not only in private houses and hospitals, but doctors' waiting rooms, barber shops, coffee houses, clubs, and business offices.
Not surprisingly, Telefon Hirmondo kept going well into the era of radio. Well, what about Britain, the great nation of entrepreneurial innovation? Our electrophone company was never a Telefon Hirmondo. It stuck essentially to entertainment and religion.
The Electrophone Company was formed in the early 1890s, first and foremost to make entertainment available down the National Telephone Company's phone lines. Electrophone's main distribution centre, Pelican House, was here in London's Gerrard Street, numbers 34 and 35, today in the heart of Chinatown. And would you believe it, they seem to have memorialised the communications past with a bar called the Exchange Bar. And there are even mobile phone masts on the roof. So why was this a great location for the Electrophone Company? Well, Gerrard Street was surrounded by London's theatreland. The later years of the 19th century saw a string of new theatres going up, among them the Palace Theatre at Cambridge Circus, where I am now, on stage. It was commissioned by Richard Doyley Cart in the 1880s. It started life as an opera house, which didn't pay, and then for two decades it was chiefly known as the Palace Theatre of Varieties. So all sorts of stuff on offer. Very tempting for the Electrophone Company. Today it's owned by Andrew Lloyd Webber. The Electrophone Company signed deals with this and many other entertainment venues, including the Royal Opera House. It was a golden period for these theatres and their clientele, says Patrick O'Connor.
The 1890s, 1900s, of course, was the heyday of musical comedy in London. The great shows by Lionel Monckton, Paul Rubens, Leslie Stewart, things like The Girls of Gothenburg and Our Miss Gibbs.
The focus of the Electrophone operation was London, although services were set up in urban centres such as Birmingham and Bournemouth. Publicity homed in on the range of venues subscribers could access. Neil Johansson, the man with memorabilia to match every occasion, has an Electrophone handout.
We have a lovely picture of a lady listening intently, and her way of describing this product, this service, is it's simply lovely listening at home to the bright music and song of London's best places of entertainment. You paid £5 a year, and that got you receivers for the use of two people, so it was a social event. Extra receivers cost you £1 a year. Now, that was a lot of money when you think that the telephone probably was costing you about £20 a year at that stage, and that could have got you a servant instead of a telephone.
A latticework gate.
Well, let's look at Electrophone kit from both ends of the line. At the Science Museum's Fort Knox of a reserve collection in Hammersmith, curator John Liffin leads the way to a vast storeroom. Stowed within it, bits of Electrophone gear from London venues.
And I've taken off the shelf an Electrophone stage transmitter.
And one prize exhibit, an Electrophone microphone.
It doesn't look like a microphone as we know them today, but actually it's the same principle. On a theatre stage that had the Electrophone service put in, there would be a whole row of these microphones right the way across the front of the stage in between the footlights. You could hear the same level of voice as the actors and actresses moved to and fro. Of course, as they moved nearer or further away from the microphones, that helped to give a sense of spaciousness, a sense of this is live, we're actually hearing this right now.
A bone, I'll pick with this sail of hell. Let him be shown at once to a dungeon's cell.
Hear, hear the tone of the maiden he loves so well. No telephone communicates with his cell.
The jury still seems to be out on the question of whether the primitive microphones of the day could be used at all or in any widespread way to create stereo or binaural sound. That's not a question I'm about to put to Alex Werner of the Museum of London. Alex, we're looking at one of the really posh perks here of being an Electrophone subscriber, the famous Electrophone table. Describe it for us.
Well, it looks like a sort of a side table. It's got three legs that rise up to a sort of hexagonal shaped top, about 3 feet in height. Then around the sides where you'd expect to find drawers, you've got hooks, and on the hooks you've got these headsets hanging down.
Describe them, because they're actually inverted, aren't they? They don't sit on the top of your head.
Sort of an upside down pair of headphones with a long bit of metal attached, and at the bottom you've got a hand grip.
Yes.
And you can hold it in your hand, and this actually allows you to listen, they said, for much more lengthy periods.
It looks a bit like a sort of tennis or squash racket with the headphones at the top.
The beauty of this way of having the headset is to have this sound in both of your ears.
And so there are 6 headsets on this particular table, are there?
Yes, this is designed really for probably an after-dinner entertainment for a wealthy family. So you could imagine 4 to 6 people at a dinner party coming out of the dining room into the drawing room to listen to maybe the last act at Covent Garden or something like that of an evening. I mean, it would be a sort of after-dinner treat, if you like.
And do you have the ability here to switch from one form of entertainment to another?
This particular version doesn't have that facility. Right. So you'd have gone through to the Royal Opera House and you'd be locked into that service, and you'd have to go back to your telephone to ask for another service. But there are versions which existed with a control that allowed you to switch between different theatres or different broadcasts in the London region.
Well, thanks very much, Alex, and fascinating to see this electrophone table, having heard one described in a BBC Sound Archive recording of a Mr. Owen Howell. And he describes the business of dialing up your preferred down-the-line entertainment.
You lifted your ordinary telephone receiver and said, "Electrophone, please." And in a moment, you were asked which theatre you wanted. And in another moment, you were in your armchairs round the table listening to musical comedy at the Gaiety, Dailies, etc., Review at the Adelphi, etc., pantomime at Drury Lane, etc., or to Covent Garden if you wanted opera. But that cost an extra £5 for the season.
And what happened when someone wanted to phone you while you were otherwise engaged?
You could be rung up on the telephone during a performance, and the operator, called in those days the clerk in charge, breaking in with, "Will you take a call, please?" And you moved a switch on the table and took up the ordinary telephone service, praying that the caller would not start by apologising and wasting time.
So, did listening at home make you lazy about actually going to a place of entertainment? Sean Street.
That didn't seem to have happened. What it seemed to have done, conversely, was make people feel more engaged with the live experience and therefore more desirous of going to experience it themselves. So, in other words, they might well listen to the opera on the electrophone and then be tempted to go out and gain the full experience themselves in the theatre.
When any show appealed to us, we went off to see it, and to enjoy it afterwards all the more for being able to visualise it.
One person who never left home to visualise what she'd been listening to via electrophone was Queen Victoria, a great enthusiast for the technology. Sean Street and Neil Johansson.
Queen Victoria heard a choir of, I think, thousands of schoolchildren singing to her through the electrophone. But we think she also used it almost as a conference call thing to sit in with some of her cabinet ministers.
And royalty continued to be interested in the electrophone and the telephone. Queen Alexandra, wife of King Edward VII, as a follower of the opera, was very delighted to be able to access it through the electrophone.
Arguably the most enduring electrophone offering of all was the relaying of church services, a ready-made product, if you like. The big attraction for electrophone subscribers was the lineup of preachers.
This was an age of legendary sermonizers who shook the pulpits at churches such as St. Margaret's Westminster, St. Michael's Chester Square, and here at St. Martin in the Fields by Trafalgar Square. One of the clergy here is Malcolm Johnson, who's written the church's history.
Well, we're standing in the pulpit here at St. Martin's, which must be one of the highest in Christendom and very creaky and shaky. It was here the electrophone, of course, was installed. The really famous person who used it a lot was Dick Shepherd. He was appointed to St. Martin's in 1914. He used to think it was great fun to whisper a message into the microphone, which the congregation couldn't hear. He used to send a message like, "Switch off now, Nelly," which was directed at a woman who didn't like his socialist views. So if he was going to say something, he would tell her to switch off.
And to avoid offending those actually attending church, the electrophone microphones, both here and elsewhere, were commonly disguised as Bibles. Yes. Fred Stanford has one down at the Amberley Working Museum.
What we have here is a large metal box that is designed to look like a Bible. Quite large, it's around 16 inches long and about 10 inches wide and 2¾ inches thick. It's black in colour, and the actual design on the outside is supposed to replicate the leather case of a Bible. Indeed, the three edges against the spine are actually painted gold to look like the pages of the Bible. There are three cavities set into the body of the Bible for three separate transmitters. This Bible would have been placed either close to the altar or on the pulpit, or in some cases in galleries to pick up the acoustics of the singing, etc. And over here we have the smaller version, which I refer to as the prayer book.
Amazing. Well, Electrophone, like Telefonhia Mondo in Budapest, worked hard to develop its customer base beyond domestic subscribers. Hotels like the Savoy here in the Strand had Electrophone connections, including one, I'm sure, to the Savoy Theatre right next door. I'm standing in front of it now. So just as today, when you could hook up to the internet or 500 television channels in your hotel room, then you had Electrophone to take you to theatre land. Well, the Reform Club here in London's Pall Mall was one of several clubs which took out an Electrophone subscription. I'm standing now in the library, which has to be one of the most spectacular rooms in London, of thousands of books, of course. And we can imagine groups of well-dined members retiring here and sitting around with Electrophone headphones linking them to, well, what? Well, I guess Gilbert and Sullivan would always score well, or the latest hit musical comedy by Lionel Monckton. Could they listen to different things at the same time, I wonder? Or were there fights of the sort that we now have over the television remote? Well, Electrophone even put in a cheeky bid to relay debates from the Chamber of the House of Commons. No chance, of course. This survey of Electrophone activities suggests a success story, but the company, in fact, never won as many subscribers as Telefonhia Mondo in Hungary, very likely because of the limited range of its programming. However, if Electrophone had tried to relay news, says Tim Crook, it would probably have come under intense fire from the powerful British newspaper barons.
The newspaper barons were enthusiasts for the Electrophone, as long as they had control of it. There would be a set-piece political event with a well-known celebrity politician. Could be Birmingham, could be Liverpool, Manchester or Leeds. And the national newspaper would pay a special subscription to the Electrophone company for the sound to be fed into their newsroom in Fleet Street, and their reporters would then hear the event live.
Electrophone never pulled a mass audience. The nearest it came to a true crossing of social boundaries was during the Boer War and then the Great War.
British wounded hear London's favourites via telephone. The free Electrophone service, contributed by public-spirited people of London to the hospitals in that city, includes an installation by which 100 patients can listen whilst lying in bed to the performances transmitted from the stages of the leading musical comedy theatres and music halls in London. The accompanying illustration shows some patients, with their mascot, enjoying a performance.
Joy, good luck to the girls who love the soldiers. Girls, have you been there?
It's all very well us talking about people in gentlemen's clubs listening to opera from Covent Garden or wherever it might be. Quite another thing for the common soldier being able to tune into populist music and entertainment in that way. That feeds into another strata of society.
So, how widely was the telephone exploited by commercial companies around the world? Well, it's a field ripe for research. For example, I'd love to know more about L'Araldo Telefonico in Italy, part of the history of RAI, Italy's state broadcaster today. And what about the surely huge range of initiatives across the United States? We just get snapshots from the written archive. For example, in Delaware, a company offered what in my younger days was called in the UK dial-a-disc. Patrick O'Connor.
If you were a subscriber, you could ring up and there'd be a list of new gramophone records and you could choose whichever one you wanted to hear and the operator would plug you in and put the record on. And so you'd hear the latest hit tune or the latest great opera aria that had been recorded by Caruso or whoever it was. People also had a device in their home where they could plug the phone into a sort of primitive loudspeaker and so everybody could gather round and hear it.
Meanwhile, the Magnaphone company marketed a kind of teach-yourself opera course via the phone.
First, you're told the story of the opera. Then the libretto is read to you, up to the point where the first aria begins. A tetrazzini record, say, is then put on. At its close, the recital of the libretto recommences and carries you along to the next aria, and so on to the end. In this way, you can have Caruso, Melba, Sembrich, Amato, Tetrazzini, and Geraldine Farrar in the same cast.
Other Magnaphone offerings were even relayed to railway stations and parks via horns. Intriguingly, though, attempts in the USA to imitate Telephone Hiamondo seem to have foundered. For example, the Telephone Herald went live in Newark, New Jersey in October 1911, boasting commentary on a World Series baseball game. But this proved a short-lived experiment on the part of the newspaper company which instigated it. Tim Crook.
They put their heart into it and they put their money into it, and it lasted less than a year. Probably because the American consumer market is very discriminating, and I don't think the technology was up to the dream and the aspiration, the expectation. Its sound was not as good as its content. Interestingly enough, the newspaper behind the Newark service invested in WJZ, a highly successful early radio station.
All the while, wireless technology was opening up new opportunities for entrepreneurs. And in an echo of the earliest days of the telephone, the singing voice was used in 1920 for a high-profile demonstration of radio in Essex. Wireless wizard Guglielmo Marconi chauffeured opera goddess Nellie Melba to his Chelmsford HQ to give a live recital over the airwaves. Patrick O'Connor.
They arranged to have this concert broadcast to Paris, to The Hague, and to London, to the Imperial War Museum, where a large audience gathered to hear it. And Melba went ahead and sang various songs, including one by Bemberg, Nymphs and Shepherds, and Addio from Puccini's La Bohème. They found they had to roll the carpet up in order to make it a bit more resonant. And It was principally heard by people who already had some sort of wireless setup in their homes, radio hams as we would call them later on, but also it was heard on transatlantic liners, and people said the sound was so clear you didn't even need to put the receiver up to your ear.
As the BBC muscled onto the UK scene in 1922, electrophone bosses insisted they offer choice, whereas with radio, you had to be content with what you were given. But the company ceased operations in 1925, apart from, it said, the relaying of church services in Bournemouth. But broadcasting down wires never died. For a start, wireless reception wasn't good everywhere. Enter Radio Relay. Sean Street.
Radio Relay was a series of companies around the country linked to the telephone through which you could pipe radio broadcasts down telephone wires. Now, this was particularly useful in blocks of flats, those kind of places where it was difficult to get a good radio signal. And you could subscribe to a radio relay company in very much the same way that 40 years earlier you could have started subscribing to the electrophone or the theatrophone.
And, would you believe, Radio Relay rented out spare capacity to the early Radio Luxembourg. Well, you can imagine what that meant in terms of populist programming. The BBC carried on using telephone lines to relay material, including music, into studios until relatively recently. And you know what my final observation is going to be, of course. Here, in a typical British street, I look down at a manhole cover that belongs to a cable company. The relaying of information and entertainment by wire, or optic fibre now, has never been more commercially significant.
Let's end, though, with a poignant moment in the history of using telephones to relay music. It's 1934. Sir Edward Elgar is literally on his deathbed. Recording producer Fred Geisberg has a bright idea. To raise Elgar's spirits, why not get him to listen over a special telephone link to his music being recorded by the London Symphony Orchestra, and then to offer comments? Elgar's biographer Gerald Northrop Moore.
They had to arrange to have the landlines cleared through from Abbey Road Studio in London to Elgar's bedroom at Marlbank in Worcester. He could hear exactly what was going on from London, and London could hear him. And Elgar was to direct the orchestra through Lawrence Collingwood, who was actually waving the baton, in the triumphal march from Elgar's early cantata Caractacus. What we can imagine is Elgar lying in bed, propped up with pillows. He pulled himself together. This was only a month before he died, and made what Geisberg called a most wonderful speech of welcome to the orchestra, saying that he was so glad to be useful again. And they recorded the march three times. Each time he had something to say, and the performance, Geisberg said, was better. Geisberg said this was a touch of Elgar in his prime.
The Triumphal March from Elgar's Caractacus. The Pleasure Telephone was presented by Edward Sackerson and produced for BBC Radio 3 by Andrew Green. And sadly, as you may know, since his contribution to that programme was recorded, Patrick O'Connor has died suddenly and unexpectedly, a valued contributor to this feature and, of course, to many other Radio 3 programmes over the years. Well, next week's Sunday feature is a portrait of the writer widely regarded as the poet laureate of the Arab world, Mahmoud Darwish. That's next Sunday evening at the same time, 9:30.